I want to show you a video clip of some university students. It does come from the USA, but please don't make the mistake of thinking that we are very different. I really hope it will give you cause for pause.
In light of all the conversation about gender and identity, we began to wonder if there's even a difference between men and women anymore. We went to Seattle University to find out. Is there a difference in your mind between men and women?
Possibly?
In general, yes. But I don't know why I think that.
Socially, currently, yes, there is. There is no need for that difference to exist, scientifically and logically.
If you think that you're a male, if you think that you're a female, that matters more than the biological difference.
There's not much difference besides what society forces on people.
And how do you know the difference between men and women?
By what people think they are. So you can't, like, judge someone just on, like, their looks.
I don't think there's any one way to really distinguish between a man or a woman, and I don't think it's necessary.
I think, yeah, there are ways to tell, but then again, you can always be wrong.
What would you say I am?
Just judging off of your looks, I would say that you're a male.
I would probably assume a man, but then you never know.
I'm male.
Why would you say that?
Based on how I look at you.
Do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, probably.
Do you think the difference between men and women matters for any reason?
No, not really.
I think most sociologists agree that the concept of gender is more of a societal construct.
I do think it matters somewhat, yeah.
To me, no. I don't feel as if it matters to me because at the end of the day, the person is just a person.
No, I don't think it should matter.
And the differences on a social level are simply a product of a biased society.
Then is there a reason to have those labels, male and female?
I don't think so. I think that it's, again, a social construct of this binary that we were given at birth. There is kind of a difference, but at the same time, if someone was to identify as one or both or as nothing, I also find that completely okay.
There may be nothing more self-evident in the natural universe than the fact that every animal species is divided into two halves, male and female. Yet the most intelligent of those species seems to be wrestling with whether male or female are actually real things. Have we discovered something new, or have we become too clever for our own good?
If I had traveled back in time 50 years, and shown that video clip, my audience would have concluded that those students had gone mad. My proposition is not that those students have gone mad or have lost their minds, but their responses are governed by a fundamentally different perception of truth and authority than the one that was in vogue half a century ago. Authority is, by definition, the power or the right to control somebody or something. There are only four kinds of authority. Together, they make up the name of a popular cheese. The first is biblical authority. Biblical authority rests in God's revelation in His Word. In His Word, God has told us His plan of salvation in Christ and outlined principles of living concurrent with His own character, which we are to take as normative in our daily lives. God's authority is unquestionable because it does not reside in some human philosophy or political agenda. God's authority is unalienable and absolute. What the creator of the universe has decreed is right, full stop. The second source of authority is rational authority. Human beings are capable of reason. We live in a rational universe which is governed by rational principles. The language of mathematics is a rational language, and so is science. A cannot equal A bar or not A. The universe is capable of being observed and quantified by rational processes. Each moral dilemma has a rational component. We have been given minds in order to determine what is reasonable and what isn't. The third source of authority is institutional authority. In any stable society, there has to be government of some sort. The government exercises its authority through the law and imposes punishments on law breaking. Some of that authority is purely conventional, such as driving on the left-hand side in Australia, and some relates to institutionally acceptable moral practice. If you steal stuff, you have to go to jail or pay a fine. The existence of institutional authority prevents a society from degenerating into anarchy. And the fourth source of authority is emotional authority. It is important, even though it doesn't carry the absolute character of divine revelation. Instead, it's personal. And it's essential because in some areas of life, it determines how a human being ought to act. Let me give you a simple, but I'm afraid, dreadfully contrived situation, which not only demonstrates this, but also, I hope, demonstrates a process on which I will have more to say later on. Young Sue is a Christian. She has to make a choice. Lucky girl, should she marry Fred or George? Her knowledge of biblical authority tells her that she should marry a Christian. Both Fred and George are Christians. Her knowledge of rational authority tells her she should use her rational faculties to make sure the man she marries is genuine, wise, intellectually her equal, and of course pleasing to look at. Both Fred and George come up with the goods in this particular area. Her knowledge of institutional authority tells her she cannot marry her brother or other close family relative. Neither Fred or George are in that category either. Both are upright, decent, handsome Christian young men who are unrelated to her. They are equally educated. And yet she chooses George over Fred. Why? Well, because she's in love with him. Her emotional authority provides a direction which none of the others can hear. Notice her wise decision has resulted from a process which involved a holistic view of authority. All four sources of authority were appropriately considered in order for her to arrive at her final decision. Western culture grew out of a Christian worldview in which all of these sources of authority were accorded their proper weight. It created a stable, morally positive society in which people were capable of making wise laws and clear as to what was right and wrong. This didn't mean, of course, that all such moral decisions were suddenly easy. But it did mean that within the limitations of our knowledge, we are able to get them right, or as right as possible with a fallen human nature in a broken world. When one of these sources of authority is out of proportion or missing, the effect it has on individuals and society as a whole is quite profound. Almost always, the first to go is biblical authority. This completely cuts the anchor chain, because the only authority we have left is entirely human. It presents a problem because not only don't we know enough to to set ourselves up as an authority, a universal authority on anything, we also lack the divine power to uphold such an authority. When biblical authority is lost, one of the other sources of authority always expands to cover the gap. The early 17th century saw the rise in what was to become modern science. Although sponsored by a Christian worldview, by the time we had reached the 19th century, the view was well established that God, even if he was there, was irrelevant. In nearly every area of life, science seemingly produced better answers than the parish priest. If you wanted to get well, you could either go to the priest to pray, or you could go and take antibiotics. The antibiotics made you better. Going to the priest and having him pray over you made you get worse. And out of this view grew the view that human beings who alone possessed rational minds were the measure of all things. John F. Kennedy typified the spirit of the age when he said, and I quote, "Our problems are man-made, for they may be solved by man. And man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings." Unquote. And this became the mantra of the secular humanist age. Rational authority had taken the place of biblical authority. Science was the flavor of the century. Unfortunately, this did not lead to the expected utopia. In fact, it led to World War II and the atom bomb. And these events, including the atrocities of the concentration camps, undermined the confidence in humanism and gave rise to philosophies such as existentialism and nihilism. From time to time, as we know in history, institutional authority has overridden all the others. You did what Herr Dictator said, whether or not it made sense or how you felt about it. But in the early 20th century, the apparent failure of Christianity and the lack of confidence in science sponsored the search for some other universal. And this modernism became first evident in philosophy, but it moved from there into literature and art and music. Biblical authority had already been rejected by this stage, but this new experimentation also took a toll on rational authority. Modern art, for example, Michael Duchamp and the Dada School. I'm sure you've seen that bicycle wheel stuck to that chair in the Sydney Art Gallery, and the music of John Cage, that is an excerpt from his suite sometime in the morning, required the observer to shift from an objective observer of reality to a creator of reality. You look at it, you created your own reality out of it. What else could you do? And such creations must always, by their very nature, be personal. The artist paints the picture and you interpret it. And there is no connection between him and you other than that. You look at the picture and you create out of that your own reality. The detachment of rational authority had begun. In the later part of the 20th century and up to today, modernism has been replaced by postmodernism. Postmodernism is critical of anything which pretends to be a universal. What matters is the personal. Everything is personal. Everything is relative. There are truths, but no truth. There are morals, but there is no morality. Rational thought is no longer all that important because it tends to produce universals, and universals conjure up images of things like bigotry, intolerance, and dogmatism. Postmodernism is also suspicious of institutional authority because it attempts to make one shoe fit all. This matters of universalism. So institutional policy is now determined by selecting the collective of individual opinions and calling that appropriate behavior for now. It has no right to legislate laws unilaterally. Each individual has a right to believe and to think and to do whatever they want to, provided, of course, that they don't impinge on someone else's right to do exactly the same thing. Under these circumstances, what authority remains? And the answer to that is emotional authority. Emotions authenticate reality. And whether you like it or not, that's where we are today. And this incredible shift in authority has a major bearing on the way people perceive truth. Authority is bound up with truth. It is inextricable from truth. How do we decide whether something is true or not? Well, we go to an authority that we trust. In our postmodern age, to what authority do people turn if they want to know if something is true? Biblical authority has been rejected. Institutional authority is distrusted. Rational authority has been culturally undermined. What remains? Emotional authority. How we feel determines what is true. And this is how people in our culture think today, especially young people. I cannot overemphasize that. The shift has been extraordinary, but it's happened. And whether we like it or not, and I don't like it, because it makes evangelism difficult, this is what has happened. You know, I'd be thinking that, well, maybe that's an over-exaggeration. I would like, if I could in a few minutes, to offer some evidence in support of that premise. It comes from a rather unexpected source. Please don't think I've lost my marbles. Advertising agencies, especially those who work for large multinational companies, are absolutely superb communicators. They, of all people, understand how their target audience thinks, and they tailor their advertisements to suit. Why? Well, they want to stay in business, don't they? Their task is always the same. Please note that. To convince you, the potential customer, that the product, be it worthless or wonderful, is something that you should buy. It's always the same. Every ad does that. They never put an ad on to turn you off the product. This is something you need, something that will enhance your life. They want to make that true for you. And to do that effectively, they have to understand fundamentally how their audience perceives truth. And they're good at it. When the commercial is over, you have to be thinking, hey, yeah, I do need one of those. That's right. That's true for me. Yes, that's right. From its humble beginnings, Georgia, May the 8th, 1886, as a medicine at 5 cents a dose, Coca-Cola has grown to be the largest selling soft drink in the world. Apart from the removal of cocaine in 1903, its composition hasn't changed. Other products have been added to the range. Yes, they have. But Coke is the same stuff since 1903. So the changes in the Coke ads reflect not the change in the product, because there hasn't been one, nor the change in the message, which is always the same, but the change in the perspective and the worldview of the people consuming the stuff. So in a humble bottle of Coke, we have a measure of cultural thinking and cultural change. In the early 1900s, Coke was marketed as a woman's drink. It was worth 5 cents a glass, and it claimed to be a drink that was refreshing and imparted energy and vigor. You notice that properties of the drink. A few years later, the company realized that men liked the stuff too. And I want you to notice that these claims directly relate to the properties of the drink itself. It makes sense to talk about a drink that's refreshing. It makes sense to talk about a drink that's delicious, or it's thirst quenching, and so on. These are objective descriptors of something in the bottle. And through the 1930s and 40s, Coke was marketed as, in the same way, the pause that actually refreshes. In the 1950s, emphasis was still the refreshment was still the emphasis. And this continued to the early 60s. And then we have this.
Coca-Cola keeps you refreshed. Coke puts you at your sparkling best. Only Coke will do when you're thirsty. And just drink Coke and be really refreshed.
Buy Coca-Cola in regular, king, and family size.
You notice refreshment, which is a product of the drink inside the bottle, that is still the emphasis. And as we head into the 60s, the emphasis is still on refreshment. But if you're perceptive, you will notice a subtle change. A subtle connection has been made between Coke and some pleasant relational experience. Please remember that the purpose of the ad hasn't changed, and neither has the product. And we come to the end of the 60s, and if you didn't notice the subtle change there, you can't miss this.
Like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and so white turtle doves. I like to teach the world to sing.
Sing with me.
Perfect harmony.
Perfect harmony.
I like to buy the world a Coke
and keep it company.
That's a real.
I like to teach the world to sing.
Perfect harmony.
And I like to buy the world a Coke
and keep it company.
Popular song of the time, I'd like to teach the world to sing, actually comes from that ad, not the other way around. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company. Let me tell you, someone from the 50s watching that ad would conclude that the marketing division of Coca-Cola had gone completely nuts. It's the real thing. I want you to notice that that claim has nothing whatsoever to do with the properties of the drink itself. A bottle of Coca-Cola has no more claim on reality than a bottle of anything else. And as we head through the 70s, Coke drinkers are told something else about the product. Guess what? Tickles your taste buds? No. Quenches your thirst? No, that's a property of the drink. Cleans your teeth? Well, no. Coke adds life. It's a soft drink. Coke adds life. And once again, please remember that the product hasn't changed, and neither has the truth that the ad seeks to convince you of. What is changing is the worldview of the culture. That's what's changing. And as we move into the 80s, the change which was begun in the 60s comes to full blown bloom. Coke is it, you know it's true.
First time, first love, oh what feeling is this? Electricity flows like the very first kiss, like the breaking of clouds and the first ray of sun.
The song The First Time, upon which that ad is a corrupted version of, marketed her single with a slide from that Coke ad.